Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today, our very special guest is Dr. Stuart Dessen. Stuart's a board member of the Association for Business Psychology, and he's founder and chief executive of the Lumina Learning. This is a leading voice on how people's behavior drives organizational performance. Drawing on decades of experience and a PhD in org psychology, Stuart's revolutionized workplace psychometrics by empowering individuality through the Lumina Spark model. Over the past 15 years, he has built a global community dedicated to moving beyond traditional assessments and towards a more nuanced, human-centered approach that helps organizations create adaptable, resilient, and high-performing teams. Stuart, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
Well, I'm in good form, in truth. A little bit jet-lagged, having got off a flight yesterday evening, but in sort of fine fettle. Apart from that, I'm excited to chat to you, and thank you for your kind words and your introduction.
It's good to have you here. We met at a British psychology conference, and you were with some colleagues presenting your Lumina model, and it caught my interest. I'm not a great user of psychometrics, but your model looks interesting. Do you want to say something about kind of what inspired you to do the work you're doing?
I can quickly reciprocate first and say that I find your model as well around personality and way of being, or sort of leadership style, equally interesting too. But thank you for inviting me to share. So yes, I've created a model through my PhD called Lumina Spark to do with personality. It's more humanistic than most psychometrics. But your question was your question more what was my kind of motivation?
Yeah, what got you into it in the first place? Let's start there. What kind of drew you into this world?
Yeah, do you want the long answer or the short answer?
Let's go short.
Okay. So it's in truth, there's a rational answer, which is it's a business and I've got a particular skill here and there's a big need for it and people like it. And then the more personal answer is it's my own journey, in that what I'm doing now, creating a psychometric with a validated model behind it, built into an IT system with apps, working with people all around the world, is kind of part of Stuart's development and a culmination of what I've been doing in my career, in that I have worked for global organizations and airlines and traveled. I have been in technology and IT for quite some time, and I like kind of building and designing things. And I've been drawn to psychology in the second half of my career. And so I've changed career directions a few times. So I guess what I've done is I found my passion, which is trying to help other people learn and grow through what I do. Although I needed to update that statement the other day to helping myself and others learn and grow.
Yeah.
To be more accurate.
Good. So let's dive into the world of psychometrics. I mean, it's a huge business. I mean, there's a lot of people doing it, all the major consultancies, kind of everyone's got their own favored kind of a psychometric. Give me a big picture view of kind of psychometrics and what's going on in the world today. Kind of what's happening with psychometrics in the workplace?
So Stuart's high level view on the world of psychometrics. You're right, it's big business. It's business that's been going on for 120 years. It's continuing to grow. It's growing faster than the economy, partly because it's technology driven, partly because we've got kind of AI coming along, significantly disrupting it. The world of psychometrics, for me, I'll say how I'm striving to challenge the world of psychometrics myself, which is on the one hand, having a scientific, robust measure with all the usual validity and evidence. On the other hand, having a deeply humanistic approach that helps people, touches them, doesn't label them, doesn't reduce them to a number, and bridging two worlds. That's not an easy thing to do, as I found out when I tried to do a PhD in it, because you often find that academics, psychologists, are kind of in one camp or the other. You know, where we met at the British Psychological Society Coaching Conference, you kind of had more in the at the humanistic psychodynamic end of the spectrum, but you can go to another British Psychological Society conference and none of them will be there. Yeah. And it'll all be about turning it into numbers. I'm striving to bridge those two worlds. So that's how I personally see it. I mean, in terms of the market, there's selection and there's development. That's kind of the big the big divide in psychometric selection. We want to figure out if you're good for us and you're really on the side of the organization. Development, a bit of both, but actually when I do development, I'm really wanting to us to help the individuals learn and grow. So philosophically, quite different applications of possibly the same questionnaires and tools.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a big critique of the number crunching, the reducing individuals to boxes and categories and skill sets. And you critique that as well. You see that as problematic.
I do. I mean, I've been through it. I'm in the unique position that I've had all this stuff done to me, 30 years ago. I've been on all the courses and had that. And then I've been in a position of trying to help facilitate others using a variety of tools. And then I've sort of converted, done the PhD and gone into, well, I'm going to build a tool that's more effective. So I'm really aware I don't want to label anyone, box anyone, reduce anyone, because I know personally what that feels like. It doesn't help your development. In fact, it can have the opposite of the intended effect. It can limit people. So no boxing, no labeling. In fact, we work hard to reduce the biases that are normally present in psychometrics. And one of the big ones for me is not just not boxing, but also not favoring kind of one end of a personality scale over another. So we typically, certainly in the UK, we tend to favor more extroverted people than introverted. Introverted people are shy. We tend to favor confident, emotionally stable people, and we're not too keen on emotionality. That's just bias, in my opinion.
Yeah.
All these things are part of the human condition. They need to be, we're going to put them in a psychometric. They need to be measured fairly and accurately with their pros and cons. I'm not talking about sugarcoating. Mm. I'm talking about a realistic assessment of what's good and what could kind of shadow in all of our different qualities. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And you just come back from Shanghai. And how do you work cross-culturally with this? Like, China, USA, culturally very different sectors in the workplace, different.
So I do. I work, and Lumina works literally all over the world. So often the meetings I have are sometimes like the United Nations with the different perspectives there. So on the one hand, it's really important to be culturally sensitive, particularly with instruments and models. And we've put a lot of energy, say in the case of China, into how do we translate in a way that works. And it's not just a linguistic translation, it's in the culture. So for example, having just come back from China, the word spontaneous in the UK sounds great. In the US, even better. You're an entrepreneur, you seize the moment. Actually, with just a literal translation, you're being disrespectful somewhat in China. And people don't want to do that. But when you really explore it, which took a couple of years, that people in China do like to seize the moment. They're not that different underneath. It's just that culturally they express it different. So a lot of our energy goes into how to frame questions and reports in a way that is truly culturally sensitive. And then it resonates. So at that level, obviously everything's different in different countries. And it's a lot of work to do that. On the other hand, maybe controversially, I think I'm here to tell you that human beings aren't that different.
Yeah, yeah.
So having come back from China, I know the underlying personality constructs, I do believe and see in my data that we're not that different, or at least the spread and the diversity is kind of similar. Yes, on balance, Japan's slightly more introverted than the US that's slightly more extroverted, but we're talking about a few percentage points.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, the structure of human beings, I do believe, personality-wise, is pretty similar.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I just I did some work in China last year. I did a group relations conference, which is like an experiential learning gig. And yeah, we had 50 people learning experientially, and some of the team we came across, we came across with some assumptions about the Chinese are probably going to be more reserved or more like this or more like that, and kind of our assumptions were smashed in the first 2 days.
I'm loving hearing that, because that's my experience over and over again. And our biases run deep.
Yeah.
I kind of like the idea of attempting to own my bias, but I need to keep re-owning it, because it's easy for the biases to come back again and make assumptions just on body language, what you hear on the TV and everything else kind of influences you. And then you're confronted with the reality again, which is different, which, is also an enjoyable thing to do.
Yeah, no, really enjoyable. It's really, really exciting work. Tell me about you've got loads of data. You've done loads of work on leadership. What's the data telling you about leadership today in contemporary organizations and where we are?
So, I mean, if I go with the data that I've got, one of the things that strikes me in the data is that there is a difference based on gender. Not a huge difference, but it is statistically significant, as they say, but it is also a kind of material. So one thing I notice in the data is, so we've got a lot of data on leaders. We've got feedback from their boss, their peers, their staff, and we've really analyzed it in different countries over a 10-year period. And to cut to the chase, on average, and it is on average, I'm generalizing, women tend to score slightly higher from their staff for being collaborative and empathetic and connecting. Men tend to score slightly higher on being confident, but possibly overconfident. That would be one generalization which is in the data. Obviously, there's counterexamples. Of course, there is. The other interesting thing in the data is companies then say that they want more collaborative leaders. They kind of espouse that. And then when we look at the data on who gets promoted, actually, you're more likely to get promoted if you're kind of a confident, optimistic male. The truth is the qualities of collaboration and empathy are sometimes interpreted as being soft. I'm horribly generalizing here. Yeah. And it does vary, of course, by culture. Having been to Indonesia to a facilitator conference recently, in that culture, it is more valued to be collaborative and empathetic. But nevertheless, the trend still persists, I think, globally. Those are interesting. I would call them biases that I'm doing my part to try and address, you know, through our work, simply by highlighting it and making sure in the reports and the feedback and the coaching we give that we don't play into that bias, that we're sort of aware of it.
Yeah. Now that allies with a lot of my experience. I don't have a huge amount of data. We have some data on we have the hidden leadership questionnaire I showed you, and that kind of gives us a spectrum of kind of leadership approaches. I mean, I go to companies and companies I'm going to at the moment are actually really quite desperate to be more collaborative. They're working in sort of very complex ecosystems. Life used to be kind of simpler, and now they really need to understand relationships more. They realize that their supply chains are global. They're dealing with like fast changing customer needs and requirements. So they need much more kind of relational skills.
Yes.
Yet they're rewarded, like performance rewarded on individual kind of individual skills. And often companies are very paradoxical in they know what they need and then they reward something else, which is, you know, why you get promoted if you kind of tick so many boxes being sort of a gung-ho individualist.
Yes, you're right. Now, I see that in your model as well, where you talk about the going back in time, the controlling leader being kind of the one, I think, that you're describing, where controlling leaders are rewarded for individual performance. And the journey that you've mapped out is one towards more connectivity. And therefore, ideally, we should be managing things in terms of collective performance. And I feel this at a kind of visceral level, because at various points, I've strived to have everybody managed collectively. And I've actually found in my experience in my own business, it doesn't always work that you end up with some people who are saying, well, look at my performance here. And then I kind of yield a bit and make adjustments. And I find myself ebbing and flowing. I don't think I have the answer on the best way to do it. Yeah. I mean, would you advocate, Simon, for dropping individual performance and going for collective performance? Is that something?
No, I just think it needs to be, I think it's very, very kind of leaning in one way. I think you need a balance. So, I mean, I'm like, even in my leadership approach, I don't say we don't need controller leaders. We absolutely do. You need to control your resources. You need to control your outputs. You need to be more efficient, you know. But if you're kind of solely focused on that, then you're going to kind of miss out on the relational pieces. So it's about getting a balance where the team gets rewarded for collective kind of behaviors alongside individual kind of performance. You know, we do know, and you'll know from your work and your Illumina work, is that, you know, we are individuals and we do have kind of feelings. We do kind of want to be rewarded for efforts. We do want to be noticed. You know, all my Lacanian psychoanalysis realizes that, you know, you need to be recognized by the other, you need to be valued, you know, so all these things come into play.
Yeah.
But they're not balanced enough, I don't think.
You're right. She's saying the direction of travel needs to be more towards the collective. And I do agree that that's kind of my experience as well. But it's a little bit like, for me, it's like the crosswinds that are pushing us back to being individualistic and controlling. It's like the culture that we're facing is blowing us in that direction. So unless we're very aware and we're working at it, that's the way we'll drift, is how I would put it.
Yeah. When I was in China, it was very interesting because the experience of the Chinese people we were working with, the participants in the experiential learning, and they were from a lot from the health sector, some were from business, but they were really describing this kind of almost dilemma, paradox that they live and work in now, where they grew up in a collectivist kind of way of thinking and everything was about the collective. And now they're really faced, like, it's a really harsh business environment. Like, you really have to kind of fight for your work, fight for your place. It's really, really
kind of... You're right, actually. I mean, I would say they've kind of got going through the transformation in 30, 40 years in the UK. It took a couple of hundred years.
Yeah,
I can see it.
Yeah, and it's real, like, you know, you can really see that tension within individuals, within groups, and how to kind of... hold that together. It's a fascinating place to go and work and observe.
It is, isn't it? It is. And, you know, at the same time, I often use it as an opportunity to look at myself and reflect on my leadership as well. So am I individualistic or am I collectivist? And my upbringing culture would have been more wanting to strive to be more collectivist, kind of in terms of how my family brought me up. And then my experience in my teens was much more holistic in terms of how I was rewarded. So I can, and then I can look at my own personality and see that there's two different bits of me. There's a very people focused bit that wants to do everything together, to the extent that I always enjoy team sports more than individual stuff. And then there's another part of me that, when I put my CEO hat on, that's kind of wants to kind of think things through and get it right, and will be quite competitive with other people in terms of figuring it all out and the sort of sparring process of figuring it out. And I've kind of got both, and of course they're both me, really, but I don't know. Do you have both?
I think you and I both run our own businesses and are entrepreneurs, which probably suggests we both have very strong messiah leadership, individualistic leadership traits, you know. So, you know, I own that. I don't pretend that's not part of me. You know, it is part of me. I have a strong voice and people kind of know Simon and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, at the same time, I work very hard to build an ecosystem of community of practice of people. It's owning both, I think. One thing I've been interested in my research is I wrote a couple of book chapters recently. One was on how messiah leadership and eco leadership sit together. And people think they say they're polar opposites. And actually, I'm finding to drive change in an organization, to drive change, you actually need some vision, you actually need some drive, you actually need some charisma, you actually need some energy, some individual energy. But if you do that kind of on behalf of yourself, then you become a narcissist, you become a controller. Yes. But if you do it on behalf of setting up a worldwide organization or a community of practice, or to build something greater than yourself, then it brings these two things together. And I think that's kind of what I'm learning about, how these things fit together.
Yeah, no, I like that. I mean, I would say when I started Lumen 15 years ago, I consciously set out not to do messiah leadership, not to be the center of attention. I kind of almost wanted to be in the background, facilitating, creating a community. But maybe the last 5-6 years, I've consciously stepped back into it because I've realized, purely from a business point of view, it's helpful to have a higher profile.
Yeah.
And in terms of what the team actually want, they're kind of, I'm getting positive feedback when I do some of that visionary leading stuff. So again, I'm trying to adjust the balance, but ultimately I'm striving to create a global community of people trying to make a difference in the world.
Yeah.
You know, through organizations and work and leadership. That's what I'm striving to do. So as you say, I mean, I think I see it as, are they opposites? I don't know. They certainly need integrating. They're probably not opposites.
No, they're not opposites. I think this integration is the important thing. And I mean, the other thing I work at in organizations is to say that, you know, a lot of organizations they'll have 10 competences of leadership, or leadership should be like this or to be like this. And I'm like, are you joking? We need a very diverse group of leaders in any organization. At one stage, the NHS, the health service in the UK, about a decade or even longer ago, that they got into this leadership fad, and they got a group of managers together, and they just kind of named, without any research, they named the 7 competences of leadership the NHS needed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just farcical. I mean, like when you think about, you know, you have surgery, you have mental health nurses, you have kind of finance officers, you know, you have all these different functions in the biggest employer in Europe, and you're not going to reduce it to 7 competences of leadership. You know, there's very different kind of ways of leading in different kind of contexts and different sectors, different kind of parts of the organization. So yeah, that kind of reducing it to kind of just one
way. Yeah. It's the book from whenever it was, the 1930s or 40s, The One Best Way.
Yeah.
Is it Frederick Taylor and the sort of approach to production lines? The role of the manager is to work out the one best way and inform everybody so that they can work in the one best way, which is kind of certainly I don't think it's a good leadership philosophy. Someone in China just the other day shared with me a book about best practice, basically saying there's no such thing as best practice. There's only your best practice, but your best practice might not be my best practice because the context is different. So I do agree with you. There's a couple of flaws we're coming up with, the 7 things that all leaders always need to do. And one of them is that it kind of varies by context dramatically.
Yeah.
One size doesn't fit all. But the second, as you highlighted, is who says the people that came up with these 7 that did the research actually do any decent research? I often find I encounter a lot of models like this. And of course, I want to be constructive and work with it, because if leaders in an organization come up with something, it's got some validity because it's their experience of their organization and they're trying to improve it. But I can often see in about 30 seconds who has done 0 research and the model is just a symbol of their bias.
Yeah.
You know, I've actually strived to involve and include relevant people and contextualize it and has given it a good go. And of course, however people's done it, I want to help them and work with them. That's my view. So I think I've got a bit of insight in terms of how our personalities impact these sorts of models, positively, negatively, overextending and so on. And that's often where I'm striving to add value.
Sure.
But back to what you said earlier, it's kind of big business, these models. It really is. You know, a lot of the big consultancies are. That's where they earn the money, is designing these models for people, taking them through a process.
Yeah, it certainly is. And how is AI impacting on the psychometric business? Tell me what's happening there.
Well, I've seen lots of false dawns in terms of technology impacting psychometrics over the last 25 years. The last major thing to have an impact was the internet.
Yeah.
In the late 90s, coming up to the year 2000. And I remember psychometric companies, big ones in the UK and abroad, being skeptical about the internet. Oh, it'll change the nature of how you fill in a questionnaire. Don't do it. It's dangerous. And they had to eat a lot of humble pie 2 to 3 years later. And we're all, the internet's had a huge impact in reducing cost, getting stuff out there, and that's fueled the growth. Then we've had numerous false dawns, yeah? So the gamification false dawn, it's kind of helpful to gamify, but it's not totally transformative. And we've had the idea that we can scrape your social media and work out your personality and Cambridge Analytica. Turns out to be largely nonsense, at least when it comes to personal development and leadership development. Maybe it's okay for a marketing company at a very high aggregate level, but not much use individually. And then we've had the idea of, you know, virtual reality helmets and so on. Yeah. Can that impact psychometrics? All these things have been incremental improvements. But I'm here to tell you that AI kind of is the real deal for psychometrics. It's already having a huge impact. Of course, we've got to say, what do we mean by AI? I mean, I could argue, I won't, but I could argue that Lumina's already used AI because we've got clever algorithms with complex maths and stats presenting recommendations and data and looking at the patterns in who you are. I'm not going to argue it's AI. It's somewhat. But I think really when we talk about AI, what we often mean is large language models. And I think large language models are already having a huge impact. I mean, we spoke about this at the BPS, you know, coaching conference. What will it do to coaching? And I did some kind of research on it myself, and I kind of found that about 20% of coaches are saying no, AI is just in shitification.
Yeah.
Having no value at all. Stop it.
Yeah.
And then you've got probably about 40% in the middle saying, watching it, going, well, it seems interesting. I'm dabbling, but I'm still experimenting. And then you've got about 1/3 of coaches that are full on technology AI advocates, and they're going at it with full zeal. What do I think will happen? I think there's a lot of really poor AI coaching going on right now. I've experienced some of it, laughably poor. However, I think it would be foolish to ignore the speed at which this is going and the technology improving and so on. So in psychometrics, this is what I've actually done. I've created a model where you can give it a personality, like from a person, a member of staff, a personality, as in a Lumina Spark model. And then you can interact with it and do a training exercise as a manager and talk to a member of staff with a real personality. And that works.
Yeah,
you'd be hard-pressed to not to know it wasn't a real person. It's good for training. That's one thing I've experimented with. I've taken our psychometric reports and integrated it with other data. And for integrating it, it's really good at that as well. Mm. So headhunters, a lot of my clients are headhunters using psychometrics, but they use multiple things. They're using it a lot. It's speeding up their report writing, their synthesis, and so on.
Yeah.
That's true. I've also had the experience, and this is an interesting one, of going to a conference, being in the audience with 100 people, and the speaker is talking about AI, and I'm thinking, well, this is a nice talk. And then without knowing I'm in the audience, they say, let's have a look at Lumina Spark, they say. And up comes, you know, a psychometric I've created and a team report that I've created. And they're using AI live to query it and create extra reports, like, you know, live. And I'm going, whoa, whoa. And the interesting thing about that was, obviously, it's I've given up, by the way, by being concerned about my IP. I think that kind of battle's been lost. AI juggernauts have consumed that. Yeah, so let's park that. What did I feel about it? Actually, I was kind of dazzled by it and thought, wow, what they're doing is really interesting. And then I partnered with them after and had a closer look at it, and it wasn't so good. So yeah, there weren't enough guardrails in there. Some of the reports, you know, the odd sentence was a bit off. And quality kind of matters here. So individuals and teams, if they're looking to you to be authoritative and say accurate things that are grounded in your experience. And if some things are off the mark, it kind of devalues it. So I had that kind of concern as well. So I guess I'm saying at the moment it's having a big impact, but there are still quality issues. But I think it's going to have an even bigger impact. Final thing I'd say on AI is I was like chairing an AI talk with a few experts in the field, because that's my secret way of becoming knowledgeable, is to get other experts to talk about it with me. And one of them was like strongly advocating for AI in assessment, and they were a real expert in it. People were consulting on it. They were earning their living doing it. And then I had a coffee with them afterwards and just asked them some more probing questions and queried what it really meant for them. And it only took about 10 minutes for them to disclose that they were petrified.
Yeah.
Despite their public persona, underneath, they were petrified that it was going to devastate their business. It was going to de-skill them with all the skill they've built over 30 years. They didn't know what it was, where it was going. And it caused them to be very cautious and cancel a few investments they were going to make in stuff in their business, because they were holding fire to see where AI goes. And I appreciated that they disclosed that to me confidentially. I'm not going to name them, obviously, because they're earning their living. Their public face is utter confidence and being part of it. So I think I've kind of learned we've all got these conflicting things going on.
Yeah.
And to an extent, I'm kind of the same. I've always been excited about technology. It's partly why I do what I do with Lumina. And I am also concerned, because I think this is the biggest change since the internet.
Yeah.
And I actually have to say, I don't know how it's going to work out.
Now, that's helpful. I mean, I'm doing some work with an AI company at the moment. They approached me, and I wasn't that interested initially, but then they said, we read all your books, Simon. We really want a critical perspective.
Do it.
And they were taking it seriously. Like they were like seriously trying to look at kind of what underpinned coaching, rather than kind of just get a bot to kind of do your basic coaching. They were kind of seriously trying to think about the discourses I talk about, like, and how they could kind of, train AI to kind of do things in a different way. And what I'm learning is that it's very good at some things. It's not very good at other things. And it's like you say, you know, first you can get bedazzled by it. It's like, wow. And then you step back and you think, no, there's kind of lots of errors in that. And we're working through kind of a process of developing it. And it certainly has, I mean, its biggest use for me is not to compare it to human coaches, but to think of it as a kind of a systems approach, which can really do large scale analysis. Like, you know, you can have a AI coach talking to like 10,000 people and do an analysis on that data, That is interesting for me. Like, you know, you can't do that with individual coaches. So if you think about using it in particular ways, then it is certainly very, very interesting. We're coming to an end of the podcast, Stuart. It's been really interesting talking with you. I ask guests two questions at the end of the podcast. One is, do you have any thoughts on what it means to live a good life? And the second one is, how can we create a good society? And I'm asking you to think about your work, how your work applies to those questions, what it means to live a good life and what it means to create a good society. Big questions.
Start with the latter.
Yeah.
What does it mean to kind of create a good society, and in the context of what I kind of do at work? For me, I've got my personal objectives around that. So I want to create an organization where, I used to say young people, but actually it's not, I don't want to be ageist. It's anybody can come and enjoy working and kind of thrive, give their best. And we're on a mission together to help make the workplace more collaborative, more human, less, in terms of your model, Simon, less sort of controlling and hierarchical, although there'll be some of that for sure. But in terms of the direction of travel, I'd like to make the workplace, let's just say, a more human place to be, where people are genuinely more self-aware, meaning they're not kind of driven by their social mask. They can be, what I'm going to say, is genuinely authentic at work. I use that word cautiously because there's a great book by Thomas saying authenticity is kind of overrated. Well, it kind of is, if it just means just, you know, speaking what's on your mind and being unsophisticated. But if it actually means being more aware and of who you really are and integrating, then I kind of want to help people be able to do that at work, because we spend so much time at work. So I'd summarize that by saying I want to make the workplace more collaborative and more human. At a personal level, what does what living a good life mean? I would say, I mean, for me, it means personally, living a good life means that I'm continuing my journey to develop myself, kind of integrating bits of me. I'm not kind of stagnating. And in that process, I'm wanting to share that with others. What comes to mind is kind of be kind. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Be kind to other people so that we kind of enjoy our life. So living a good life to me means being kind and doing what you believe is the right thing. Something like that. How does that sound?
Sounds very good. Very good. Yeah. It's been a really interesting talk, Stuart. Thank you so much for being our guest. We really appreciate it. And good luck with your work and stay.
Yes, Simon, thank you for having me on. Thank you for your personality, your model assessment and my leadership and your books and for everything you do as well. And for having me today. Thank you.
Great. Stay in touch. Bye-bye now.